This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Welcome to the Spectator Podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman. On this week's episode, we're investigating the truth about plastic, the environmental enemy du jour in 2018. We'll also be trying to find a compromise on tuition fees, if there is one, and asking whether the Church of England are the most ruthless property tycoons in the country. The single biggest televisual hit of 2017 was David Attenborough's Blue Planet 2, which smashed to the top of the ratings chart like a marlin cresting a wave. But it also spawned a national outpouring of anti-plastic sentiment. Can we do anything to stop our rivers and oceans being polluted with single-use plastic bags and coffee cups? Or is the whole issue much more complicated than we ever thought? Ross Clark looks at the government's new proposals in the magazine this week, and I'm now joined to discuss this issue by Fraser Nelson and Jonathan Bartley, co-leader of the Green Party. So Fraser, is the government's war on plastic a mistake, or are you just dubious about its efficacy?
I wouldn't say it's a mistake as such. There's no doubt that politically it's quite astute. There is a consumer backlash against plastics right now, quite a strong one. I mean, the reason, for example, that Iceland this week said it was phasing out packaging is not because the government's telling it to. It's because it sees, quite rightly, a way of getting a market advantage. The era of recycling means that millions of people are now got these, you know, great big tubs they put out for recycling filled with packaging which they didn't really want. And they're thinking to themselves, first of all, look at all of this stuff. I wanted to buy broccoli. I didn't really want the plastic and the film that comes with it. And yet here I am having to despoil the environment, go through all of this hassle. It's a headache. And what the Conservatives have correctly worked out is that plastic is becoming the new CO2. And 10 years ago, people who hadn't really thought about the carbon footprint were suddenly starting to do so, and they wanted, there was a fashion. And the Conservatives responded to that. David Cameron went off to see an iceberg that was shrinking, or as it turned out, expanding. And now Michael Gove, who was behind it back then, is now right now working out. This is an agenda. People have seen the Blue Planet. They're very concerned about plastic waste. They want the government to do something, so the government is acting. So politically, it makes perfect sense. But what you never hear about is, if not plastic, then what? And I think that people have been given the wrong impression that if they were to use, for example, you know, different sorts of bags, this would be a great impact on the environment. I think the environmental case is a lot more in the balance than the political case.
Jonathan, do you agree with this? Cotton bags, for instance, don't exactly have the best environmental provenance.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Fraser said. You know, it is a bit of a fad. The bigger picture is that we've got to reduce what we consume. We need to think about the way things are manufactured, what we're manufacturing and how. If we had a government that was really serious about this, we would be, I mean, we have got, of course, the credit where it's due. We've got the consultation on taxation of plastics coming up. We'll see what that produces. But we need to be looking at the whole way we produce. You know, it is not logical to be sending a lot of plastic across to China mixed, because we can't deal with it here.
Well, the Chinese have said they're not going to do
not
it anymore.
Of course. Yeah. So why are we not looking at how we produce a circular economy here? And it is absurd, because most of us, when we get, as Fraser said, when we get our broccoli and we look at the packaging, you know, we didn't need all that packaging. We just wanted the broccoli.
Well, the question is, though, we might not have thought we needed it, but did we actually? Now, one of the things that struck me recently is packaging that you see is only about 1/10 of the plastic and packaging used in the process to make that food. And about 1/3 of our carbon footprint comes down to what we eat and consume. The question is, if it wasn't for that packaging, might there be more food wasted? Might that have created to a greater carbon footprint? And the plastics, there's no doubt that they can extend the shelf life by, you know, sometimes as much as 20 days in the case of meat. Less food wasted means less carbon footprint. And you have to work out that the plastics does form and perform an incredibly valuable role. I mean, not just in reducing food waste, which is good for the environment, but in managing to get food to people who in shops that might not otherwise stock it. There are huge parts of the country where, you know, people live in neighbourhoods where you've got corner shops who tend not to stock fresh fruit and vegetables, or didn't about 15 years ago. But now, when packaging can greatly extend the life of these things, they can. So there are lots of benefits, both environmental and in other ways, to the packaging, which means the cost of food goes down, the shelf life is extended, and overall, the carbon footprint could be a lot less than what it is if you were to use paper.
That's quite striking, Jonathan, because we do waste about a third of our food anyway, don't we?
Yeah, tackling plastics is not what's going to, you know, tackle climate change. I mean, same, you know, argument applies to fridges. Fantastic. They extend the longevity of food. But we need to be looking at the round and the total impact in terms of what we're doing, what we're producing, what we're consuming, how we recycle, how we build in reuse and recycling into everything that we own. And of course, you know, just delving down into plastics, you can't treat every plastic as the same. There are single-use plastics, there are other plastics.
So are there good and bad plastics?
There are different types of plastics. The bigger picture is about how much we consume of plastic and what we can use in terms of alternatives. But also looking at, you know, if however much we stop the use of plastics, we, you know, say tomorrow we stop the complete use of plastics and all our fish were happily swimming in the sea, it wouldn't solve the bigger issue, which of course our seas are warming up and we're killing the fish because of climate change.
The question is, are our seas more or less likely to warm up if we avoid plastic? And from the sea, when this was looked at a few years ago, before the Attenborough film, before the consumer trend changed, the studies tended to say that there wasn't really that much environmental point to these 5p plastic bag taxes. Because if you look at the other forms, for example, these cotton bags, they're very fashionable, the tote bags. The Spectator has got this tote bag with the Spectator's name on it. But, you know, that is the equivalent to something like 175 single-use plastic bags. So you would have to use that bag quite a lot to make it, on balance, better for the environment. So the idea of cracking down on plastics was hitherto rejected on environmental grounds, because if you look at the picture in the round, if you look at what people would use if we're not using plastics, you find it doesn't really help the planet more broadly. Now, that's what's changed. You won't see these studies being commissioned by government right now because the fashion has changed, and you're only seeing one side of the argument, and in my opinion, it's rather misleading. That's why we've called the cover story The Truth About Plastic, because it's something which you're not being really given now by the government.
And this sounds to me like it is very much about fashion. You mentioned, Fraser, in your first answer, David Cameron and his husky obsession, which disappeared when it turned out that actually voters didn't want to pay more on their energy bills, for instance. So is there a risk that this could fall by the wayside in a similar way? Everyone's still fascinated with plastics after Blue Planet, but give it 6 months and people will be talking about another television series that has nothing to do with the environment.
I think it takes a lot longer than 6 months. Let's take diesel, for example, a great example. The government was encouraging us to drive diesel cars because they had less CO2, and it took several years to work out that the pollution from nitrogen dioxide produced by diesel was a greater environmental concern, and now diesel cars are now on the way out. So I think these trends take a long, long time before government can get itself in the position where it objectively looks at every environmental dimension of this. And I could be wrong, but I think the environmental case against plastic for food packaging is pretty thin, because plastic does have so many environmental benefits.
Jonathan, I think a lot of people listening to this podcast will feel quite powerless, because they do want to do something, but it seems that every new thing they do, a bit like switching to a diesel car, could actually turn out to be worse for the environment. So what can someone on an individual level do that's actually effective?
I'm not sure that coming, I think Fraser has eloquently made the point that if you take every issue in isolation, you do with plastics, you do with diesel, you go with the fads and the trends, and you don't have an integrated approach, you're not looking at the broad picture and not raising the big questions and making the big transitions in the economy. Yes, there are the little things that we can do. I've just gone vegetarian, you know, a year and a half ago. I'm trying Veganuary. I'm thoroughly enjoying it. You know, that makes a contribution. But actually, that isn't the thing that is going to solve climate change. We need that lead from the top. We need that policy response. And we need it to be integrated. And it does, you know, it's the big economic questions. It's about how we use less energy. It's, you know, it's about the big home insulation program that we need to cut down on energy use. It's about making that switch to renewables, clean technologies, harnessing the power of the wind. You know, we are an island nation. It's quite right that we're leading the world in terms of wind production, but there's a heck of a lot more that we could be doing.
And so if you were in charge of DEFRA, what would you be doing that Michael Gove isn't?
Oh, where to start? I would certainly not be putting the subsidies that I presume DEFRA lobbied, or I don't know how hard they lobbied against, in the budget speech in terms of North Sea oil. There's all the budgetary issues that the Treasury and the decisions that the Treasury are making, pulling the rug from under renewables. I'd be lobbying very, very hard the Treasury around the budgetary decisions that are being made. I'd be looking at, in the consultation, not just looking at tax and subsidies around plastics, but tax and subsidies right across the board, looking at everything we produce and consume in terms of its environmental impact, subsidising the stuff that's good, that can be reduced, reused, recycled, the stuff in the production process that is good, and taxing the stuff that is bad. So you make it make financial sense for people in terms of what they consume.
Fraser, I don't want to create a modern version of Godwin's Law where there's only a certain amount of time before we start talking about Brexit, but does this have an impact on plastics?
Not really. The EU, only a couple of days ago, was coming down, or cracking down on exactly the same theme. I mean, right, this fashion against plastic is something you see in Britain and America and the United States, even in India and there, where food wastage is horrifying. It's something like 40% of Indian fresh food never reaches consumers because of lack of packaging. But they're cutting down there too. So people are worried about this right around the globe. So I don't think Brexit will make, much as though Michael Gove might like to insert it in there somehow, I don't really think it will do. I think what will matter here is consumer fashions. I mean, the government is following consumers here, is not leading. And I always think the role of government isn't to follow the crowd necessarily, but to point out, have you really considered, for example, if you, the shelf life effects and other things like that, which they're not doing right now. But then again, governments, I suppose, in democracies tends to follow the crowd, especially conservative parties who need a new cause and see in the war against plastic a way of trying to reach out to an audience who they haven't reached out to before.
Thank you, Fraser and Jonathan.
Enjoy discounts of up to 50% in the Berry Brothers and Rudd January sale. Visit bbr.com to browse the full range of wines.
And next, today's students are expected to spend £9,000 for the privilege of a year's university study. It is unsurprising, therefore, to see so many of them seduced by Labour's offer to scrap tuition fees. Can and should the Tories respond? In his column this week, James Forsyth urges caution, but will Theresa May fall for the same mistakes as Ed Miliband? James joins me now, along with Louis Coiffet, Associate Editor of Wonk E. So James, how high are tuition fees on the agenda in Tory HQ at the moment?
I think they're definitely moving up the agenda. I think in the aftermath of the reshuffle, it was quite clear that Joe Johnson had been moved because he was blocking a review into tuition fees, which is something that Theresa May had tried to announce at conference. And then the Department of Education essentially pulled the rug from under that announcement by saying, well, it's not really a review to anyone who'd listen. And so I think there will be a review coming soon. And I think that is a big political and policy mistake.
Louis, do you agree with that it's a policy mistake?
I wouldn't say it's a policy mistake. I think the current system definitely needs fine-tuning. I think that the Conservatives are at risk of losing more young people, including students, if they don't look at it.
Why is that?
I think the current system, for those who are about to start, has some slightly strange elements to it. So, for example, there's a proportion of people who pay no fees at all, and then the people who earn the most, they pay less than people who earn less than them, which doesn't really make sense.
James, you are very against this policy change as well. Just explain why.
So I think there are a couple of tweaks I think that should be made to the system. I mean, the interest rate, which is currently a little bit over 6%, is way too high. I'd take that down to CPI. So basically people are just paying back what they've received in assistance. I don't think there should be a way for them to generate more money than there otherwise would be. I also would reintroduce maintenance grants because I don't think it's fair that people who come from the most deprived backgrounds end up leaving university with more debt than people from more affluent backgrounds. And then I think this is a slightly longer term shift, but I also think there should be something that holds universities responsible when students default on their loans because they can't pay them back. Because the current system isn't really a loan, it's much more like a graduate tax. And because the universities have no responsibility for what happens to their students after they leave, there is at the moment a kind of perverse incentive to get as many people through the door on a £9,000 course, which is cheap to teach, regardless of what that actually does for that young adult's kind of future earnings potential, life chances and the like.
Louis, it's also the case that this policy would have an impact on universities' individual funding pots, isn't it?
Potentially, yeah. I mean, you've already had a few percentage of their surpluses wiped out by the announcement by Theresa May of the freeze, which isn't sustainable in the long run. But I like that we're talking slightly radical ideas around tuition fees because I think we've got locked into a certain logic for quite a while. I wouldn't entirely agree with James's proposal, mainly because that would put universities responsible for things that they can't really control. So they can't really pick what course, they can't influence what courses students choose or who those students are, nor can they influence what kind of jobs, what kind of salaries the students go into. So it seems a little unfair to put too much of the liability on them.
I mean, my argument would be universities can choose which courses they put on and at what cost. I was talking to someone who was on the advisory board of a a polytechnic turned to university, and they admitted that they discussed how they could teach certain courses for less than £9,000 and still make money. But they didn't want to do that because they thought it would make those courses look less prestigious. So they were less worried about the fact that students might not be able to pay the loan back, but that they might get fewer people through the door because people looked at that course and said, oh, you can do that course for £8,000, not £9,000. It must be less good than the course offered at the university down the road, which is charging £9,000.
So is it also the case that different departments cross-subsidise? So it costs a lot more to educate an engineering student than it did, for instance, to educate me with my English degree.
Yeah, there's lots of cross-subsidy within the system because it's a system. The idea that it's a market where just one student comes in, pays £9,000 and they should get value for that £9,000, that doesn't really work if you think about different disciplines, if you think about kind of the long-term sustainability of the system. I think there's some real challenges there because you end up in a kind of logic where you basically end up with arts courses for posh kids, and you incentivise universities not to enrol people with disabilities or women or people from ethnic minorities because they'll earn lower salaries later if they're then made accountable for those salaries.
And what's the feeling amongst universities about this change of political mood towards lowering tuition fees, having spent so long trying to persuade, for instance, Ed Miliband not to go for that policy in the 2015 election? They must feel as though they're having a much bigger battle now.
I think they feel like they've been having quite a rough ride for quite a while. I think the main thing they need is stability. So to have the kind of major review hanging over them, to have Brexit hanging over them, you know, these are huge businesses in many ways. They're multi-million pound businesses for the most case, and they need stability so they can plan, they know what staff they need, they know what resources they need. So it's quite kind of mundane logistics. So the more instability and kind of indecision there is in Westminster, the more kind of difficult it is to run a university successfully long term.
James, how much indecision is there still, or is it really starting to look like a done deal in the Conservative Party that fees will have to go down?
There'll be huge resistance to that. I mean, I think there'll be a massive row because...
A cabinet level row.
I mean, because what... Okay, universities are absolutely vital to Britain's kind of post-Brexit future economics. If you look at the reasons to be optimistic about the British economy in the next 30 to 40 years, in large part they derive from the advantages that our world-class university sector gives us in things like research, all the new industries like artificial intelligence, gene editing, you name it. Anything that hurts those universities' funding models is going to cause a row in the Tory party. I mean, it's also going to cause a bigger row because lots of people in the Tory party see this as an attempt to kind of beat Jeremy Corbyn by going a bit Ed Miliband. And I don't think you can beat Corbyn with Miliband. You know, that lots of people tried this in the
Labour...
Sounds
like the worst game of stone, paper, scissors I've ever heard
indeed.
Of.
Indeed. But, you know, this was essentially tried in the Labour leadership contest that followed their defeat in 2015. It didn't work. I don't think it will work with the general public either. If you go around saying, well, yes, tuition fees are too high, yes, they're unfair, so we'll cut them, Labour are just going to trump you by saying, we'll abolish them. And actually what you need is distinctively conservative solutions to these problems, not an attempt to kind of try and offer a kind of Labour-light Diet Corbyn solution.
Louis, what do you think the Conservatives' best bet is?
I couldn't possibly comment on something like that. I mean, universities have a lot of different missions. And I think in Westminster particularly, we fall into the kind of three-year Hogwarts trap where we think that's what a university is about without really thinking about the full diversity of the sector and the range of missions it's got to do. Yes, for some people, for some universities, it's about being world leading, it's about getting those high salaries, it's about preparing the future leaders of the country and businesses and the rest of it. But actually, there's other institutions who are focused on teaching, there's other institutions who are deliberately trying to widen participation to get new types of people to come into the sector for the first time in their kind of family history. And often those are in places where there hasn't been a kind of history of higher education participation. So I think we often fall into this trap of thinking about university in this quite narrow sense. So I think whatever happens in number 10 or elsewhere in Westminster, we really need to think about the full breadth of the sector and what it's trying to do.
Does there also need to be a rethink of the number of people who should be going to university as well? You've talked about widening participation, but this is still different to saying, for instance, 50% of young people should go to university because that's the route they should take to have a good, high-earning life.
In the global economy in the future, I don't think more education is a bad thing. I think trying to work out how we pay for it and how we share the costs is the challenge, but having more education and a more educated populace is no bad thing.
I'm not disputing that Westminster tends to look at universities through the kind of three-year residential course prism. But I think the university sector can't escape blame here, because if you look at the fee level can go up to £9,000. You look at how few places have responded to that, and those students were saying, actually, we're going to offer you two-year courses at, you know, concentrated in and charge less than £9,000. How many universities are charging £9,000 right across the board? You know, the university sector is not responding creatively. I mean, I think if the university sector was leading, Westminster would respond, but I don't think it is.
I think part of that is because the university sector is obeying the incentives that have been set for it. So education is not a normal kind of market good. So people are buying proxies, they're following kind of signals. If they were going to go for a cheaper product, they would have less cachet. They think they would be paying for a less good product. So the sector is just responding to the rules set for it, I would say.
Thank you, James and Louis. And finally, recent disclosures have revealed that the Church of England, in addition to their spiritual duties, are hard-nosed property barons, selling off lands whilst maintaining subterranean mineral rights. So what's going on? And why does any church need £8 billion while its congregations are dwindling? Harry Mount investigates in the magazine and joins me now, along with Damien Thompson. So Harry, what have you found out this month about the Church of England's property dealings?
Well, there's been this big story this month that the Church of England has laid claim to 500,000 acres of underground mineral rights across the country. It actually only outright owns 105,000 acres above ground.
How does that work?
That you can still maintain underground or mineral rights to that acreage you owned in the past. And the Church of England in the late 19th century had just over 2 million acres of England. And before the Reformation, the Catholic Church obviously then owned a third of the whole of the country. So I've written this article saying just how incredibly big, as property speculators, first the Catholic Church and then the Church of England have been ever since 597, when St. Augustine came over here to convert us heathens into Christians.
So this is nothing new then, in that case, if they're laying claim to these rights?
No, not at all. But actually, we like to think of the Church of England as a sleepy, useless organisation. But there's still this vast landowner, 105,000 acres, and have got £8 billion in combination of property and equities. It's less than it used to be, but actually in the last 10 years, they did badly in the crash of 2008, their fortunes have soared.
Damien, are the Church of England as canny as they could be with this property portfolio and these rights?
Well, they certainly haven't been canny in the past, because I was religious affairs correspondent of the Telegraph in the early 90s when they managed to lose £800 million, which was a lot of money in those days.
And a quarter of their portfolio then, yeah.
Indeed, absolutely. Yeah. And what I remember was, obviously they were very embarrassed, but they were also very, very deceitful and lacking in transparency when it came to trying to find out what had actually gone on. And I'm reminded, reading your brilliant article, about how the way churchmen deal with money seems to oscillate between naivety and greed. And I'm sure that this was the case before the Reformation as well as after it, although I slightly recall that Harry's description of Henry VIII's biggest single property transfer in British history, which I think is...
What do you
I
call
describe
it?
Biggest act of theft.
Oh, yes. Okay, no, I agree. No, it's complete thievery. I speak as a...
I mean, nobody minds...
Nobody minds
taking things from Cardinal Wolsey, but the destruction of the monasteries. I mean, you can see it today in Reading, where I grew up, which is the ruins of Reading Abbey, a heartbreak.
Jewel of Berkshire.
Would have been.
Yeah.
I wonder whether the situation is changed by the fact that you have an Archbishop of Canterbury now who worked in the city. I mean, what was he, treasurer of an oil company?
Yeah.
So he knows what he's doing. What I'm not clear on, and perhaps you can clarify this, is to what extent the Church of England is going to need vast reserves of funds, because its congregations are falling off a cliff. And it's got all these small churches that it's going to have to maintain because they're listed, and yet nobody's visiting and nobody's using.
This mean that the churches can now re-roof and put the lead that's been stolen back on?
Well, they still have, as you say, this vast amount of churches and a declining amount of clergy to look after. but the difference in their expenditure and their income is growing, whereas during that scandal in 1992, when they lost £800 million, as Damien said, that was the first time in the history of the church commissioners, who've basically looked after the portfolio since the 19th century, that the income was exceeded by the expenditure. So it's never going to be as enormously rich as an oligarch with £8 billion, because it's got these enormous obligations. But at the same time, as property has soared over the last 10 years and equities, it is doing as better than it's done basically ever since the 60s. And Damien's quite right. Despite having this large portfolio, they haven't been very good at running it. There was this moment in the 1960s, I write about, when Max Rain, Lord Rain, a property developer, saw that the church was selling off its huge amount of land holdings very, very cheaply. It sold off 2 million acres in the last 120 years or so. And he said, rather than selling it off, let me develop it with you. And a brilliant property developer. And he made them fortunes on existing land on the Hyde Park estate, which they still own and have owned since the Middle Ages, and actually made very clever speculations in Tottenham Court Road, where they actually bought land and made money on it. He then amicably stopped working with them. They on their own, or the church commissioners, were no good, leading to that disaster in 92 when they continued to speculate and buy property at a time when interest rates were soaring, and they did disastrously badly.
So it sounds as though you both agree that the church is currently in a financially savvy position at the moment, as opposed to a naive position. What is it doing with these mineral rights? Is it blocking fracking on the land that it lays claim to?
Well, actually, I got in touch with the Church of England, and they said, well, I had no reason to disbelieve them. All they were doing was following their statutory duty in registering these rights. They weren't going to start to do anything with them. And they categorically denied they were going to do any fracking at all, which one news report said it would. But you would only register them if you wanted at some stage to take advantage of them.
Damien, what do you think the Church might do to take advantage of these rights? Do you think fracking would be a good plan? It would certainly boost the coffers.
Well, the problem is that fracking is opposed by so many fashionable environmental lobby groups, and the churches have never met a trendy lobby group that it hasn't genuflected in front of. So I rather doubt that they'll go in for fracking. I wonder what the future looks like, given that the number of churches is really astronomical in terms of the number of people attending them. At some point, will the pressure to maintain all these properties begin to eat away at their financial portfolio?
So, sorry, you mean it's astronomical in terms of the ratio between church and number of churchgoers?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, what's happening is that they can't knock down these churches, and it's actually rather difficult for them just to shut parishes. So churches are opening, you know, once a month or something, and they no longer have the parishioners who would pay for its upkeep and who would work tirelessly to maintain the building. So you've got the problem of lots of churches which are, you know, pretty enough to preserve and, you know, listed, but not really interesting enough to maintain for tourists. And the local newly arrived gentry who might have bought rectories at knockdown prices when the church only very, very stupidly sold them off in the 60s and 70s, and would like to use them at, you know, Christmas and Easter or for weddings and things like that, but otherwise aren't interested at all.
Harry, what do you think the church can do about its surplus of properties, of places of worship?
I think it's already very slowly doing it. I mean, it's got 16,000 churches in the country, and those which, as Damien says, aren't architecturally very attractive or very historically important, are being sold off. And I think that's completely fine if no one's coming to them.
Sorry, what are the church-going figures at the moment?
Right. Well below a million, right, on a Sunday.
Okay, so yeah. 16,000 churches and around 800,000 churches.
50 ago, yes. And then some
falling
churches
all the time.
Yeah. Yes. So I think what they're doing is the right thing, very slowly selling off those ones which are pretty much empty. And then you have those which are architecturally very pretty. There's one near my parents' cottage in Wales, a beautiful medieval church, which is just closed but too important to turn into a house. I think the Simon Jenkins solution is the correct one, is that you use them for community reasons as almost like just sort of public halls, and you keep perhaps just the chancel consecrated for services. Or you convert the rest of the church into a house, but you cannot have thousands of empty buildings with no one visiting them. And very slowly they're doing that. And to be fair to the church in this whole argument about property, they have to walk this delicate tightrope between sweating their assets and also behaving in a Christian way, and where they own houses to rent out, keeping affordable housing. And so actually in that story with Max Rain in the 60s and 70s in the Hyde Park estate, they got into terrible trouble in the 80s because they were doing so well and the area gentrified. The local working classes could no longer afford to live in church-developed properties. So to be fair to them, it's a difficult dance between God and mammon.
It is. I always think that the sale of the rectories was a great mistake, certainly the sale of the rectories at those prices. Because I remember I had a friend of mine who's a very left-wing vicar saying that actually he was all in favour of the church keeping a substantial number of rectories because they could become a tremendous resource for the parish. They'd make the job more attractive to potential rectors, and they would help build a local community around the church because you could have endless meetings in a rectory. I'm not sure that churches lend themselves to becoming community centres. We're constantly been hearing for decades that this is the answer, that they will become like a sort of marketplace that they supposedly were in the Middle Ages. But I just don't see it happening. I mean, literally haven't seen it happening, despite all the talk.
It's also a bit defeatist, isn't it, Harry? Surely that does the church have to accept that it's in decline?
Well, I think it's undeniably is. I mean, I speak as an agnostic Anglican, but longing for it to survive and longing for as many people as possible to go to church. But I think it is a fact, as Damon says, that it's in decline. So you have to know how to deal with that decline. I think there's a, like so often, the best answer is the wonderful poem Church Going by Philip Larkin, who describes the idea of a broken down church in 100 years' time, 1,000 years' time, and no one coming to visit except for the odd elderly lady touching some holy stone. And he concludes by saying, as an atheist himself, that people will always be surprised by finding a hunger in themselves for more seriousness. So I think there will always be a demand for some form of religion, and probably Christianity for a very long time. So it would be terrible if you got rid of them altogether, particularly while you have this money to keep them going.
It's a dreadful prospect if the churches become sort of repositories for New Age bollocks.
Yeah, exactly. No, as long as they mustn't remain Christian.
Fortune tellers.
Sort of people seeking some kind of spirituality, but nothing beyond.
Exactly. Yeah. Spiritual, but not religious.
But, I mean,
run a mile, as soon as somebody describes themselves.
How much further from Anglicanism, English Anglicanism, is that really? I mean, a lot of people just go to church to have a quiet, reflective time, not necessarily to agree with everything.
Well, they can't do that if their vicar's an evangelical. I was talking to a country vicar friend of mine, Ravi Holi. I had him on the Holy Smoke podcast, and he may have said it off the record.
Too late. Different interview.
Something along the lines of, you know, God help us if the evangelicals capture a local parish, because he has to look after five or six of the parishes. And I think this view is held by a number of vicars, obviously not evangelical ones. But the idea is that the evangelicals will swoop in and turn it into something which is very unambiguously Christian and missionary in its ethos, but not necessarily recognisably Anglican.
But don't more people turn up to those churches?
Well, true believers will turn up, and people who don't subscribe to everything will feel it's not for me, which they already do, I guess.
Thank you, Harry and Damien, and both of them also appear on this week's episode of the Holy Smoke podcast. And that's all for this week. You can subscribe to this podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to all our other shows, including the Spectator Books podcast, where Sam Leith is speaking to Fiona Sampson on the 200th anniversary of Frankenstein. And if you enjoy the podcasts, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed on this podcast, as well as great pieces by Lionel Shriver, Colin Freeman and Douglas Murray. And I also write a daily email rounding up and analysing the day's politics. It's called The Evening Blend, and it's free to subscribe. Everyone from the Prime Minister downwards reads it, and you can join them by going to spectator.co.uk/blend. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.